Caution, the contents of this podcast may be historical, but they're still served piping hot. We're brewing up the classics here on the Coffee House Classical Music Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Coffee House Classical Music Podcast. My name is Asa.
And I'm Allison.
Hopefully you'll recall we spent a good long time over the past few weeks discussing Haydn, and during those episodes, alluded to many younger composers who were directly influenced by Haydn's teaching. Mozart, of course, was one such figure. However, we decided to step into the Romantic era and instead explore the life and times of the one, the only, Beethoven.
Dun, 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 dun.
Now, we've done a one-off Beethoven episode, episode number 44, which we do recommend going back to for an analysis of Symphony number 9. But in this Beethoven series, we're going to take a closer look at each of Beethoven's compositional periods, beginning, of course, with his early period, and for the following two episodes, we'll look into the middle and late. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
Beethoven's early period is generally listed to be between about 1794 to about 1800. Now keep in mind, Beethoven himself was born in 1770, and so these periods that we'll be talking about now and in the future episodes don't actually encompass his entire time spent as a student, but rather while he was a functioning adult musician. So just prior to the start of this period, so when he was still a student, Beethoven was actually taking lessons with Haydn, which started in 1792. And not only did his teacher instruct him on the proper classical composition techniques, but he also trained him on how to break the rules. Thus, right from the beginning, Beethoven was set up to be revolutionary.
Of course, Beethoven had several teachers throughout his young musical life, and they all influenced him in some way, but Beethoven was uniquely a musical genius on his own. Surprisingly, Beethoven and Papa Haydn didn't really get along as well as one might have thought. Although Haydn was immensely impressed with Beethoven's abilities, he was very tired from several trips to London around that time, and didn't spend as much time with Beethoven as the pupil had hoped. Beethoven actually studied with several teachers during his time with Haydn, but did so in secret so as not to offend his senior.
Though Beethoven is quoted to have said that he, quote, never learned anything from Haydn, he did still dedicate his Opus 2 piano sonatas to this teacher. However, Haydn had one request of him, which was to sign just one composition as, quote, Beethoven, the student of Haydn, and Beethoven never acquiesced to this request. One of the secret teachers that Beethoven found during this time was Salieri. And though he is often pitted as a mortal enemy of Mozart, Salieri was actually an excellent classical composer in his own right. And through him, and also through his own immersive studies, Beethoven was strongly influenced by Mozart going into this early period.
All of this tutelage took place in Vienna, Beethoven's newly adopted home. He had wanted to come to this city from his hometown of Bonn, not just for instruction, but to also endear himself to the wealthy patrons of the city. And he was immensely successful in this regard, partly thanks to his associations with Haydn. But he was also an extremely accomplished keyboardist and had no issues performing well in courts. Though he was a freelancer his entire musical life, Beethoven did experience the benefaction from several wealthy patrons, particularly Count Waldstein.
The Count was somehow related to most of the prominent houses of the Germano-Austrian Empire, and word of Beethoven's musical charms quickly spread easily from house to house. One of Beethoven's first actual homes in Vienna was also kindly lent to him by Prince Lichnowsky, who remained one of Beethoven's most monetarily dedicated patrons.
Can you imagine that? Oh, I'm going home. Which home? The home the prince lent me. I'm just
How
borrowing
luxurious.
The prince's house.
Well, I think he was allowed to rent it. It wasn't just given to him. And, you know, this was all well and good for Beethoven, as he was actually at this time in charge of the care for his two younger brothers. By the middle of his early period, he had actually gotten himself fairly well established in Vienna, and both brothers were actually able to come there as well. By 1796, one worked as an apothecary and the other gave music lessons. Beethoven had also recently began publishing music in 1795, so his musical ideas were finding broad play in the world at large.
All of this rising notoriety finally culminated in Beethoven's first European tour. And this was highly successful. Beethoven endeared himself to more and more aristocratic listeners with both his piano playing and compositions. He was now being contacted by publishing houses for new works and making quite a name and quite a bit of money for himself. Most of the compositions to come out of this earlier period are piano-based. There are numerous piano sonatas and two concertos. Most of these piano works are a little easier, but still require an artful touch to bring that musical sparkle.
And this period did see the composition of the First Symphony. Already, Beethoven was showing ingenuity with the genre, as it starts out on the fourth rather than the tonic, but that theory is not of a concern to us today. And sometimes the Second Symphony is also grouped into this early period, but it's actually considered more of a transitional piece into the middle period. Though his early period encompassed almost a decade, Beethoven didn't produce any string quartets until the very end with the Opus 18, which consisted of six quartets in total, and this was finally published in 1801. We'll be looking at the number four of this set shortly.
It seems that Beethoven was unsure at this time if he could master the genre. He had big shoes to fill if his idols Mozart and Haydn, both masters of their craft. One of the final pieces Beethoven created during the early period is the famous Moonlight Sonata, one of the most angsty piano works still to this day, and also far more romantic than classical. It was also published in 1801. And unfortunately, by this time, Beethoven began to realize something was wrong with his hearing. He was by no means fully deaf quite yet, but for someone who literally made a living with sound, any hearing loss would be detrimental. And that's where we'll leave the story for now. So let's turn to the music, particularly the string quartet number 4, Opus 18.
There is a bit of mystery around this particular quartet. It's difficult to say exactly when Beethoven actually wrote it, even though it was published with the 1801 set. There's apparently no known sketches of this music, which is unusual for Beethoven, as he was a diligent hoarder of his sketch planning books. And this leads some experts to think that the quartet was actually a conglomeration of earlier ideas that Beethoven had assembled actually while he was still in Bonn, way before arriving in Vienna.
Some critics of the quartet feel it is the weakest of the six in its set, with the argument that it's in C minor, which was a deep and stormy key that had powerful meanings to Beethoven. However, it has been faithfully defended by others, saying that not all things in C minor have to be the most powerful, and that it does, in fact, have power in its own right. So why don't we take a listen?
Starting off, of course, with our first movement. So, quick quiz, what form is the first movement in?
Sonata form, of course.
Of course! So, here is our first C minor theme. This movement does have a second theme. It is almost directly derived from the first theme, but is in E flat major instead. And this is another main point of criticism against this apparent monothematic work.
But even if the theme isn't original, the treatment of it certainly is. The viola is put in charge this time around, and then Beethoven also writes a pretty and prominent counter melody in the first violin, adding a nice conversation between the instruments.
You may have also heard a criticism of Beethoven in general that regards the end of his symphonies. You may know that he kind of hammers on the 5-to-1 progression for measures and measures and measures beyond what is apparently needed, according to some critics. Well, that may have started in his early period. When we hear it here, even at just the end of his first theme, Beethoven is driving home that 5-to-1 cadence.
Something fun Beethoven does near the end of the exposition is have the entire quartet play in unison octaves. He has also marked this pianissimo, which makes this whole phrase sound like a joke, perhaps following directly in Haydn's footsteps here. As we get into the development section, Beethoven seems to mess around with the theme not only in keys and modulation, but also now with timbre. For example, he has the first violin screeching up into the stratosphere, but suddenly drops down 4 octaves, completely changing the sound.
He also has a back-and-forth motif between the first violin and the cello, thus getting the really high and really low voices in on the melody. The development section itself isn't actually terribly long, and even the treatments of the second theme aren't terribly complex.
However, returning to the recapitulation is quite the event. Beethoven has the inner voices, the second violin and viola, on repetitive 16th notes, almost resembling a tremolo. The dynamics rise and grow, and the violin and cello make upward sequences, and the inner voices slowly move up stepwise. Until, finally, we get to the explosion of the recapitulation.
What is special about Beethoven's take on the sonata form is that his recapitulations are not just direct copies of the exposition themes. So as you can hear, he has really raised the bar of the drama here with the complex eighth note interjections by the cello that were not present when the theme was first presented. And then we're back to the reinforcing tonic chords. But wait, there's more!
Now the major second theme, as though none of that just happened. And then those cute unison lines again, but they also take us into the coda with a minor twist. The ending of the piece is actually more subtle than grand. There are a few bars of unison sforzando, but then the quartet actually winds down with a final unison sforzando, meaning we're already back to a quiet dynamic. But then for the next one, The first and second violins drop out, leaving only the viola and cello.
We do end with three hammers of the tonic chord, but not as robust a cadence as Beethoven has demonstrated elsewhere. But that's just the beginning, so let's see what the second movement has in store.
This movement is labeled a scherzo. It's a type of dance, not to be confused with the minuet trio. It's still a three-beat pattern, in this case 3/8 time, and we've also moved from C minor to C major. It all begins with a solo second violin. And like Haydn so often did, Beethoven employs the use of canons here to create his harmony. And maybe one day we'll talk about Tchaikovsky's unique use of canon to create harmony.
That's later in the Romantic era.
Exactly.
So this canon is a bit more complex. It's almost like a fugue instead, since the viola actually enters at the interval of a fifth. Beethoven continues the canonical entrances, but they occur at different times during the phrase. So this first entrance that we talked about is at the end of the phrase, which occurs 6 measures after the start of the piece.
The next instrument to enter is the first violin, but they enter 5 bars after the previous entrance, and finally the cello, but only at 4 bars after the last new addition. After all that canon, the quartet falls into a regular melody with accompaniment.
But throughout this movement, Beethoven really was all about those canons, or quasi-canons as it were. But here's 2 other examples where the instruments mimic each other in a building sort of way before finally getting together for the melody and harmony. And here's another bit of humor. Beethoven has written all the instruments to be playing 16th notes. The second violin and cello are playing a non-moving line, while the first violin and viola move around. However, this creates quite the dissonance. For example, Beethoven has the non-moving voices playing B natural, but the first violin dips down from B natural to A sharp or B flat, and you can very easily hear this half-step dissonance.
In the past, you've heard us talk about the Romantics loving the diminished chord, and here, Beethoven really leans into that and has the solo first violin play a several octave diminished arpeggio. While that may have been looking forward into the Romantic era, this next section actually sounds more Baroque. Think Vivaldi's Four Seasons as a point of comparison.
Remember how straightforward our initial theme for this movement was? Well, now Beethoven is going to jazz it up a bit by having each instrument contribute to the melodic line, and he also adds some more syncopated and dotted rhythms rather than just straight eighths and sixteenths. And coming to the end of the piece, it's a very Beethoven ending, and perhaps even a bit operatic sounding.
Moving on to the third movement, Beethoven now finally sticks to the classical formula as we get our traditional third movement, a minuet and trio. But right from the start, he confuses the meter a bit. There is a pickup to the first downbeat, which is fine, we expect this. Then the rhythm is half note, quarter note, etc. to build the phrase. What throws it all off is that Beethoven writes sforzando on the quarter note beat 3, meaning the next corresponding downbeat doesn't have as much emphasis, which is exactly opposite how this minuet meter is usually played.
In this next section, Beethoven has the cello play a sort of drone, but not just a held note. The cello actually still gets to play the same rhythm as all the other instruments, but just holds steady on the same note as the other instruments move upward. The trio section of this movement is almost comical. At first, it seems slower as the lower parts are playing very long, held, and tied notes over several measures. But the first violin is playing arpeggios with repeated triplet notes on each beat. So the actual tempo hasn't changed, and these triplets are actually quite fast, and it sounds frantic in a very unnecessary way. But then the first violin actually resolves it in a very elegant way, as though to say, I don't know what you mean, I'm perfectly calm.
As is standard with a minuet trio movement, there is a da capo al coda, meaning the instrumentalists start reading the music from the beginning again. However, Beethoven requests that this time around, instead of just playing allegretto, they play Puoi Allegro, and this is coming off the end of the trio, which ends with sparse chords and 4 beats of rest. If it hadn't been made clear already, Beethoven has learned the art of musical humor well.
And he said he didn't learn anything from Haydn.
Proven wrong here on the coffee house.
Beethoven busted. And now for the final fourth movement. It's a rondo, and it's also in 4-4, which is refreshing coming out of the previous two movements that had 3 beat time signatures. Beethoven plays with the contrasts here. Obviously, the first theme is dramatic and busy, but our second theme immediately feels more calm simply because the note lengths are longer.
This section also gives off some vibes to me of some of the German dances Beethoven would go on to write. As the rondo returns, Beethoven likes to keep it interesting. In this rendition, instead of leaving the eighth notes just to the first violin, Beethoven invites the whole quartet to get in on the fun, and as a result, it sounds more fast and furious.
Next, Beethoven brings back all the fan favorites. We get those staggered entrances once again in the third theme. And again, it's a smoother and lighter feeling theme simply because there are longer notes. ¶¶
As the rondo does the rondo thing, coming back for a third time, Beethoven's trick with it now is to have both the first and second violins take turns playing parts of it and trade off, overlapping. Beethoven then actually brings back the second theme, this time with the second violin adding complex decoration under the melody. And then, much like he did in the minuet, Beethoven scares us with tempo. He sets it up with the first violin solo holding a note with the fermata, and then we jump right to speedy prestissimo.
A reiteration of the rondo theme, and then we actually have a coda theme where Beethoven really makes sure we understand the tonic is C minor. But right as we're getting the hang of that, Beethoven actually modulates us into C major for the ending.
And that concludes our look at Beethoven's early period in this episode. Join us next time when we come back to Beethoven's middle period. If you enjoyed what you listened to today, please go ahead and leave us a review on iTunes or Google Podcasts, following us on Spotify or wherever you happen to listen, and share us with a like-minded friend, family member, colleague, or stranger.
Share us with all the strangers.
Please do. For the Coffee House Classical Music Podcast, I'm Asa.
And I'm Allison. Thank you so much for listening. The String Quartet in C Minor, Opus 18, Number 4, was performed by the Orion String Quartet. You can find the Coffee House on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Email us at coffeehouseclassical@gmail.com.